Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to welcome you to this briefing on the lead crisis and safe drinking water, lessons from Flint and other drinking water emergencies. The Northeast Midwest Institute's Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program is pleased to be your host today. I'm Michael Goff, President of the Northeast Midwest Institute, and I want to thank you for joining us. Hopefully you signed in as you were entering, but if you didn't, please sign in as you leave. We'd like to send you a copy of the slides today and hopefully a recording as well of the briefing and other information we may have following up on the presentation. For starters, some background. The Northeast Midwest Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research and education organization committed to economic vitality, environmental quality, and regional equity for the 18 states of the Northeast and Midwest. The Institute's Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program was launched last November to build on the Institute's longstanding engagement in water quality research, policy analysis, and policy education related to safe drinking water. The program works towards solving imminent, critical issues regarding revision of the lead and copper rule, while also building a regional and national awareness of the need for solving drinking water issues. As we begin, I want to thank our great partner, the Northeast Midwest Coalition on Capitol Hill, for its active engagement in our critical work on behalf of our region's access to safe drinking water. To lead off our program today, I'm very pleased to introduce one of the coalition's leading members on safe and accessible drinking water, Congressman Dan Kieldy. Congressman Kieldy was born and raised in Flint, Michigan. He has been one of the most vocal and effective leaders in Congress on the Flint water crisis. He has fought relentlessly for increased federal support and assistance for the people of Flint since the beginning of the water emergency, while also working on solutions to prevent future contaminations in other communities across our nation. Congressman Kieldy was elected to Congress in 2012 and previously served as a Genesee County Commissioner and Genesee County Treasurer. He also was a co-founder and served as the president of the Center for Community Progress, a national nonprofit organization dedicated to building a future where vacant and abandoned properties no longer exist. We're honored and grateful to have Congressman Kieldy with us today, and I want to call on him now to offer opening remarks. Congressman Kieldy?
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. I'll stay back here behind my... Yeah, you got the right seal. Well, first of all, thank you for doing this and for all you've done for my hometown, because I first became aware of this largely because of the work of a lot of the folks in this room. This issue, obviously, is one that is really important to me personally. It is an issue that is a national question that we need to spend much more time and energy on, and we certainly can't think that it's going to take another crisis like what my hometown has gone through in order to raise attention to this problem. I know most of you are aware of the circumstances that led to Flint's situation. It's caused by a couple of things. One, a backdrop of disinvestment in older communities, and especially communities that have had really significant population loss. When we have systems like water systems that are ratepayer supported and population loss occurs, the size of the system that those participants in that ratepayer supported system have to support doesn't shrink along with the population, so the costs become higher, the ability to reinvest is diminished. So that backdrop is an important sort of predecessor to the series of events that actually caused the crisis in Flint. The backdrop also contributed to the financial stress that the city has been facing and continues to face, which led to the appointment of a financial manager, which led to a series of decisions that were based largely on short-term economics. The decision to switch to using the Flint River as a water source, if you're from Flint, and I grew up in Flint, to hear that, if it weren't so sad and if the result wasn't so predictable, it's almost like a punchline to a joke to think that we would use the Flint River as our water source when we are now surrounded by the greatest source of surface water, fresh water on the planet, but already have, through the connection with Detroit, or now the new authority, access to potable water that's safe. So there were some decisions that were made that were based largely on really short-term economic questions that didn't consider anything beyond just dollars and cents written on a ledger. and that was a huge mistake. The water in the river was fundamentally different. And so this is a problem that we see play itself out in lots of different ways. So the real question, and the reason I'm glad that this briefing is taking place, is to take the right lessons from the Flint story. Understand that it's not just about water, but it is about water too. Understand that it's about what we do when we fail to invest, not just in communities, but in the essential underpinnings of a civil society, decent infrastructure. We can't let this go without taking the lesson of Flint to make it right for those folks, but to avoid the possibility that this happens again. We were able to get some help for Flint through Congress, and a lot of folks participated in that, and it was bipartisan, and it was unusual to get $170 million in a time when additional funding for any particular community is almost impossible to get. I mean, we don't do earmarks anymore. But to see leadership on both sides, after some real work, I don't know, Jordan, 11, 12 months of arm-twisting and negotiation, we were able to get that help through. And of course, between what the state and the county, state and federal government have spent to make it right for the people of Flint, not just the cost of infrastructure improvements, but the cost of sort of making up for the suffering that those people have experienced, the ongoing help that we need, kind of makes an argument that goes beyond the policy or moral argument, makes a pretty good fiscal argument, that we're all going to pay one way or the other if we don't get this right. And in Flint, it's going to be $500 million if we don't commit another dollar for what could have been prevented with some really thoughtful use of a lot less money. We got to get that right. We have to force the issue in two important ways. One which is in law, one that should be. The one that's in law is to take away any excuse about the public not being aware of the fact that they might have a problem with lead in their water. Any violation now under federal law, under Kildee-Upton, the provision that was passed by the House, two no votes, which we'll try to figure those no votes out, and was included in the bill that ultimately passed that sent relief to Flint, simply requires immediate notification if a local water service operator of the state doesn't provide that notification. So in other words, to arm people with information that is the best and I think strongest way to get government to act, to have a population armed with knowledge. We've seen how that works. It does work pretty well. And the second step, which I think is really important, is to stop accepting a standard for water quality that is a standard that we wouldn't accept for our own families. And dial back on the acceptable level, in this case of lead, in drinking water. 15 parts per billion, ask anybody in healthcare, ask anybody who understands the impact of lead on human development, on brain development, on other aspects of health, it's too much. And why do we have that number? Because it's convenient. It's convenient and it doesn't force us to do what we're going to have to do sooner or later anyway. And that is figure out we better spend that money in a smart way, the way we should have done in Flint, or we're going to pay a price in a way that is just so astronomical it's hard to imagine. Just imagine what happened in Flint and the cost of what happened in Flint for a city of less than 100,000 people taking place in every community that is one mistake, one bad decision away from being the next Flint. How many are there that are one decision away from being in that same position? Dozens, hundreds, who knows? We have to prevent that. We've got to make it right for the people of Flint. One of the ways to make it right is to make sure that what they've gone through doesn't happen in vain and that other communities are protected from that eventuality. So thanks. Thanks for everything you do. Thanks for all the work you keep doing. And let me know how I can help. All right. And I have to go back to the committee markup now. So. Thank you all. And continue on.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
thank you, Congressman Keelty. We appreciate so much you being with us, and we appreciate enormously your great interest in this issue of safe drinking water. It's now my pleasure to introduce Elin Betanzo, the director of the Institute's Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program and a nationally recognized expert on safe drinking water. Elin will begin today's briefing and introduce our speakers. Elin?
Thank you, everybody, for coming this afternoon. I'm going to just start with a little overview of the Safe Drinking Water Act and how that treats our public water systems. So safe drinking water starts at the source and at the water treatment plant, and the majority of our regulations require monitoring at the water treatment plant. We can treat any source of water, any quality, to be safe to drink. And so we have our regulations that apply at the water treatment plant to make sure that any contaminants are removed before water goes out into the distribution system. So we have our surface water treatment rules, the groundwater rule. They affect microbial water quality. And then we have a whole range of organics, inorganics, and radionuclides that are sampled at the water treatment plant. So then the water goes out into the distribution system, but water quality is constantly changing as it travels through our pipes. So we have a few more regulations that apply within the distribution system. We have our disinfection byproducts rules and our total coliform rule that has additional sampling in the water distribution system. Then we have our lead and copper rule, which is a unique rule among all of our drinking water regulations. EPA regulates lead in drinking water because it's a potent, irreversible neurotoxin, and there's a risk of lead in drinking water anytime water comes in contact with lead. Our sources are rarely contaminated with lead, and the majority of distribution system materials do not contain lead. Lead comes into contact with drinking water in our smaller pipes and fittings and fixtures. So that's why sampling for the lead and copper rule happens at customers' homes. The largest potential source of lead in drinking water are lead service lines, and industry estimates that we have between 6 million and 15 million lead service lines in service providing water to customers' homes in the United States. So in the past, municipal plumbing codes have often required the use of lead service lines in connecting homes to the water distribution system. And in many, if not most of our municipalities, we have divided ownership of the service line. So we've got a service line that connects the water mains to the homes, and the water mains, of course, carrying water with no lead, but then we've got a mandated lead service line that is owned by the water system from the water main to the property line, and then it's the homeowner's responsibility on private property. So that is the kind of first point where lead comes into contact with drinking water, but there's also sources of lead within the home. There can be lead solder, which was outlawed in 1986, but plenty of homes still have old lead solder existing in their pipes. And there's also lead and brass fittings and fixtures. And up through 2014, their fittings and fixtures marked lead-free could have up to 8% lead content. So the majority of our homes do have a source of lead in contact with their drinking water. So the lead and copper rule is applies to public water systems, but I want you to also think about this. These same fittings and fixtures and pipes are in private homes on private wells. So there is the same risk of exposure to lead in drinking water at homes on private wells, and there's no regulations applying to those. They're possibly at even greater risk of lead exposure because it's very rare for private homeowners to have corrosion control in their private wells. So just keep that in mind because the rest of this presentation covers public water systems. So now I'm going to give you an overview of what's required in the lead and copper rule. It is a treatment technique rule that is measuring whether corrosion control is effective for reducing lead exposure in the homes. So right off the bat, the lead and copper rule requires corrosion control for public water systems serving 50,000 people and more. For systems smaller than that, if they meet certain criteria, they would also be required to maintain corrosion control. So next we have water quality parameters. And these are water quality parameters are measured at the treatment plant and in the distribution system. And these are meant to be indicators of whether corrosion control is maintaining lead at the proper levels. So a public water system will get a violation if they go outside of their range for water quality parameters. However, since the original lead and copper rule, there's been research that has shown that these water quality parameters are not reliable, consistent predictors of lead release in the distribution system or in customers' home. So the fact that they get a violation isn't really necessarily tying the health risk with the actual concern there. The lead and copper rule establishes a maximum contaminant level goal of 0 parts per billion, and that means that 0 parts per billion for lead is what is safe to drink. It also establishes an action level of 15 parts per billion, and that action level, what that means is when 90% of the samples a water system takes are 15 parts per billion or less, they're in compliance with that action level, and all that means is that corrosion control is effective for controlling lead in the distribution system and in customers' homes. But that also means that 10% of samples collected could have any level of lead in them whatsoever. So there's that. It doesn't mean that all samples are below 15 parts per billion. When a water system exceeds 15 parts per billion, they do not get a violation. It's an action level. It triggers them to take additional actions. Sampling with the lead and copper rule involves collecting the first sample out of the tap after 6 hours of water stagnation in the home. And that means no water use in the home. And so that first liter sample will measure lead that has settled in the faucet and in the plumbing in the home, but it's not a sample that comes from the lead service line. And research has shown that samples that are collected from the lead service line are consistently higher than that first liter collected out of the tap. So our compliant samples with the lead and copper rule are not measuring the range of exposure that customers might be experiencing to lead in their drinking water. The number of samples collected varies based on population served by the water utility. And so the highest number of samples required is 100 samples for a system that serves 100,000 or more. But if they meet certain criteria, they can reduce their total number of samples that they collect. And so most of our largest water systems across the United States are only collecting 50 samples every 3 years. So that's not very frequent. If there are changes in water quality, they're not getting timely information back on the quality of that water. So then, when they collect those samples, if they exceed the action level, they don't get a violation. They're triggered into additional actions. So they're required to do public notice, let the public know that they have elevated lead in their drinking water, and public education, and that's letting people know what they can do to reduce their risk of exposure to lead in drinking water. And then they'll be triggered into a lead service line replacement program. And when they're triggered into this program, they'll be required to replace 7% of their lead service lines each year. Now, I said before that service lines are a shared responsibility between the water system and the homeowner. So what this ends up happening in most water utilities is they do partial lead service line replacement. And that's where they replace the lead service line that's on the water utilities portion, but leave the lead intact on the private side. Research has shown, and there's an EPA Science Advisory Board report that shows that partial lead service line replacement can increase lead exposure in the short term, and it does not decrease lead exposure over the long term. So this is lead service line replacement in the lead and copper rule is supposed to be the big remedy to reduce lead exposure in drinking water, but what's happening right now in our water systems is not effective for reducing that risk. So a water system will get a violation if they fail to implement a lead service line replacement program, but if you see, if they're sampling every 3 years, that means that they could be having 4 years of increased lead exposure before they get any violation that's forcing them to make a meaningful public health response. So the lead and copper rule does have a lack of timely and meaningful violations associated with it. So now I want to talk about the D.C. lead crisis. This happened right here in Washington, D.C. between 2000 and 2004. And this started off with a treatment change in November of 2000 where the D.C. water system switched from using chlorine to chloramination. They did not do a study of corrosion control before they implemented that treatment change, and it resulted in increased lead release throughout the throughout all the homes in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of lead service lines here, especially at that time. They've been replacing some since then. So DC was sampling under the lead and copper rule at the time. They observed that the lead results were increasing. So the response that they chose to take was they dramatically increased the number of samples they were taking, because there is a provision in the lead and copper rule that says you can replace through testing. That means if you collect a sample from a lead service line and it's 15 parts per billion or less, we consider that replaced, and you can use that to meet your 7% replacement target. And so they started sampling and sampling and sampling, and they found more and more and more lead in the drinking water. And so the biggest problem here was that they were not notifying the residents that they were finding increased lead in the drinking water. And it wasn't until 2004, when this story broke in the Washington Post, that people understood that they had been exposed to lead in their drinking water for 3 years. So in response to the lead crisis in Washington, D.C., the EPA issued short-term revisions to the lead and copper rule. They tried to do some really quick turnarounds to address some, especially those public notification issues in the D.C. lead crisis. And they identified a need for long-term revisions. It's 2017 right now, and we still haven't gotten the proposed rule for those long-term revisions. So then looking at the Flint water crisis, this water crisis also started with a change in source water and treatment. Again, in Flint, they did not evaluate the impact of those changes on water quality that would be distributed to the customers. So that should have been the first trigger here, that they should have done a water quality evaluation. That would have either stopped them from changing the source water, or they would have identified treatment that would have guaranteed safe drinking water to the residents of Flint. But that didn't happen. So the next trigger should have been that requirement for corrosion control, because Flint serves a population more than 50,000. They are required to maintain corrosion control in their water system, but the state of Michigan did not require them to. So then the next trigger that should have happened in the lead and copper rule would be that routine compliance sampling under the lead and copper rule. But in Flint, they were not sampling in homes served by lead service lines. They were using some sampling protocols that minimized the detection of lead in drinking water, and they invalidated some of their highest, they found reasons to invalidate the highest samples that they collected. So in July 2015, when there was some indication that there was an issue of lead in the drinking water, they did not exceed the action level. So that's when Dr. Mark Edwards came in and started doing lead sampling in Flint. And so when he did his sampling, they got homes that had lead service lines. They used wide mouth bottles. They eliminated pre-stagnation flushing. And they collected samples from the lead service line. And so through this testing, they found lead levels that were substantially higher than the city of Flint's compliance sampling. And this indicated that there was widespread lead contamination in Flint. But because those results were inconsistent with what the city had found, it took a pediatrician in Flint to identify that there were measurable public health impacts in Flint before there was any remedy there to address the water quality in Flint. So that is the story of the lead crisis in Flint. Now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. William Rhodes now to talk about the rest of what happened in Flint.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about some of the work that we did at Virginia Tech regarding biological contaminants in drinking water. And I'm really going to focus on a subset of drinking water pathogens called opportunistic pathogens. But backing up a little bit, our current regulatory and monitoring requirements for biological contaminants in drinking water really only focus on traditional or fecal-derived pathogens. And these pathogens are, the source of them is upstream of the drinking water treatment plant, and they're very, very effectively removed at the treatment plant, and they actually have a hard time living and growing in the drinking water environment. Opportunistic pathogens, on the other hand, are very adept at growing in this low nutrient environment. They're generally present in drinking water, but at very, very low concentrations. And then when the conditions are right, they can begin to grow and amplify and cause disease. And that typically happens in large or complex building plumbing systems, not at the treatment plant or in the distribution system, but in individual large buildings. And so there's a parallel here to this risk in the lead and copper rule, in that we need to assess and address risk from opportunistic pathogens in taps at high-risk buildings as well. And there's a whole host of opportunistic pathogens that our lab is generally concerned with, but I'm going to just talk about one called Legionella. And Legionella causes a severe and often deadly pneumonia called Legionnaire's disease. People get it when they inhale very small water droplets that have the bacteria in them and deep inside their lungs. And it typically affects immunocompromised people, so at-risk buildings involve things like hospitals and long-term care facilities, but it can affect healthy people as well. There's about 5,000 cases that are reported to the Center for Disease Control every year, but we know that that is vastly underestimated or underreported because not every doctor is going to test every pneumonia case that they treat for whether it's related to Legionella or not. And so the incidence of Legionnaire's disease has been increasing over the last decade or so. Legionella is the most prevalent and deadly pathogen in drinking water in the United States today. And we spend about $430 million on healthcare treating Legionnaire's disease every year. And as Elin said, people are aware that there was lead contamination in Flint, but people are often not that aware that there was also two large incidences or large clusters of Legionnaire's disease outbreaks in Flint. After the water switch, 91 people were diagnosed with Legionnaire's disease and 12 people actually died from it. So in the absence of any federal monitoring program, the at-risk buildings in Flint, they weren't aware that they had a Legionella problem until much, much later. And the Flint River water was actually more conducive to Legionella growth than the water that was supplied by the Detroit water system. On a very basic level, the water was warmer during the summer months, and Legionella can grow more rapidly in warmer water. The change in water source changes all of the background chemistry and microbiology, and the Flint River water also has more nutrients or bacteria food in it as well. But some of the critical changes were actually due to how corrosive the water was. And the corrosive water led to an increased number of water main breaks in the city of Flint, which can introduce contaminants as well as remove scale and biofilm off the interior of pipes contaminating the water. The corrosion caused more iron to leach into the water from the iron water mains. And iron is a key nutrient for Legionella, and it can actually increase how infectious the Legionella are. And it also caused rapid loss of our chlorine residual, which we put into water specifically to keep bad bacteria from regrowing in the distribution system. And when we were in Flint, there were whole regions of the distribution system in Flint that we didn't ever measure a residual in during the Flint water crisis, meaning that it was much more prone to bacterial contamination. And all these things that Flint experienced during the water crisis, we're going to experience on a national scale in the coming years, whether it's 10, 50, or 100 years from now. Right now, the American Society for Civil Engineers gives us a grade of D for our drinking water infrastructure integrity. So we know that that's something that we need to obviously address and quickly and efficiently. But in the meantime, we also have to help mitigate some of these other public health risks that are partially a result of the aging and deteriorating infrastructure. And one of the ways to do that is through regulations. And as I've said, there are no national regulations for Legionella. It's mentioned in our primary drinking water standards as a treatment technique bacteria, meaning that if the water treatment plant treats the water properly, then they've done everything that they should do to prevent Legionnaire's disease cases in the distribution system. And we know that that's simply just not true. And Flint is unfortunately a really good example of that and how the background chemistry and microbiology can contribute to Legionnaire's disease outbreaks. There is a legally enforceable standard that's fairly recent in 2015, issued by the American Society for Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. It's called ASHRAE 188. It has to be locally adopted into the code to be enacted, and it really only identifies buildings that need to have what's called a water management plan in place. So it helps identify these at-risk buildings and outlines that water management plan, but it really does not make specific recommendations to building owners and operators on how to safely operate their building, when in fact, for Legionnaire's disease and Legionella growth, all of the liability is currently with the individual building owners. So if we accept the fact that municipal water supplies and water treatment in general has a role to play in mitigating or triggering Legionnaire's disease, future regulation for Legionella growth could really focus on monitoring chlorine, because we know that it's effective in preventing the growth of Legionella, and monitoring for Legionella itself in these high-risk buildings. In Flint, if they had had to monitor in these high-risk buildings, they would have noted a drastic change in the water quality and the amount of Legionella in their water, and they could have prevented a lot of the disease cases from occurring. Any future regulation is going to be very complicated because there are a lot of stakeholders involved in identifying, diagnosing, remediating, and preventing issues with Legionella in these individual buildings. And so it has to really involve everybody. And so it's going to be a difficult task to make a rule that is effective yet fair for all these stakeholders. But we think that, you know, at Virginia Tech, we think that it's something that needs to be considered due to the fact that Legionella is currently the most prevalent and deadly pathogen in drinking water, and we don't have any national standards to prevent it. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to Eric Olson.
Can I ask one question? When was the last time the lead copper rule was updated substantially?
The short-term revisions became effective in 2008.
They were pretty minor.
Small.
Yeah, it's really
so 1991.
Okay. It's been 16 years since there's been a major revision.
26.
All right.
Do you want to switch spots?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, thanks for coming, folks. I'm Eric Olson. I head up the health program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and I'm going to talk a little bit more broadly about the lead and copper rule and some of the legislation that's pending to try to address some of the issues. So we do know that millions of Americans drink water that contains contaminants. In fact, NRDC issued a report yesterday that I'm happy to get to you, or you can find it on our website at nrdc.org, identifying sort of widespread contamination. Over 77 million people get water from systems that violated the drinking water rules, about 27 million of those violating the health standards. The contaminants include lead, which is the main focus today, but also arsenic, pathogens like Legionella and Cryptosporidium, radionuclides, and many others. These are some of the more widespread contaminants. But as you've heard a bit about the lessons from Flint, there are a couple major sets of lessons I'll go into. One is, obviously, the lead and copper rule needs to be fixed. The other that you've just heard about in some detail is that we really don't have protections currently against Legionella that are meaningful, and we need to strengthen our rules to deal with that. So just how widespread is this problem? You heard earlier from Elin that we actually have somewhere between 5 and 10 million, maybe more, lead service lines. 6 to 10 million is the American Water Works service number. We did a report last year that found 18 million people are served by systems that violated the lead and copper rule. That may be that they're not testing the water as they're required. That may be that they actually are not treating it as they're required. 4 million people are served by systems that exceeded EPA's action level for lead. 9 out of 10 of those violations never faced any formal enforcement, and 97% were never subject to any penalties. So what we have is a situation where a lot of systems have issues. We don't know exactly how widespread they are because a lot of systems aren't really testing like they're supposed to. And where they do test, we know a lot of people are getting exposed, and there isn't really much enforcement. So what are some of the shortcomings? This is actually a lead service line replacement effort going on. one of the big problems with the current lead copper rule that's been around since 1991 is that lead service lines in general are not going to be replaced under that rule. It's a very complicated rule. I'm happy to talk to anybody for the next 3 hours about the details of it, but it's incredibly complex and there are a lot of interacting parts. The service line replacement would take up to 13 years. It only applies if you exceed the action level and other actions don't address the problem. And there are fundamental problems also with whether a full service line replacement is required under the rule or not. A lot of water systems take the position that they don't have to replace the portion of the service line that it is underneath private property. So that was a result of some litigation in 1991 we were part of on the other side. But the fundamental problem is, as you heard, if you replace part of the service line, that actually can cause the lead levels to jump afterwards because you're shaking up the line, you're getting particulate matter released, you can cause galvanic corrosion. So partial lead service line replacement is not a good idea, is the bottom line. We need to fully replace those service lines. Replacing part of them isn't going to help us. That's not fixed in the lead and copper rule. Secondly, corrosion control. There are a lot of complexities to corrosion control. We heard both in Flint and in the DC examples, corrosion control really was not practiced in a way that was solving the problem. And fundamentally, that's going to be a big part of our solution. And the rule needs to be strengthened on that front. Monitoring is also a major issue. There are a lot of problems with how monitoring is currently done. And EPA has tried to address that through guidance document that came out February of last year, but there's still issues with monitoring. Reporting problems, I mean, some of that has been addressed by the legislation Congressman Kildee just mentioned, but there still are issues with making sure people understand the information that's provided to them and can act on that. The action level itself, it's a really weird concept. 15 parts per billion is not a cap level, a maximum level that's allowed in your water. You can have up to 10% of the households that are tested being above that without any limit. And therefore, you see systems that are in compliance, technically, that may have levels 50, 100 parts per billion in some homes that are tested. So it's a big issue, and it's something that needs to be fixed. And finally, there isn't a at-the-tap standard. There used to be until 1991. EPA changed that to this complex lead and copper rule. So there are a bunch of pieces of legislation pending before this body that address these issues. I don't have time to go into a lot of detail on them. Mr. Kildee has a bill, H.R. 1974, the No Lead Act. That's a clever acronym. But it would address several key issues, including reporting and notification and public education. It would require clear inventory of where your lead service lines are and disclosure of that. It's a big problem that there isn't a clear requirement that all lead service lines be inventoried by all water systems now. So a lot of systems don't even know where the lead service lines are. And it would also require the action level to gradually be decreased from 15 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion to 5 parts per billion. Mr. Pallone has another bill, the Safe Drinking Water Act Amendments, H.R. 1068. That would overhaul the Safe Drinking Water Act in many ways. It has a few provisions that address lead, including addressing monitoring, improving public notification, and some definitions and other provisions regarding lead service lines, but it's not as comprehensive and detailed as Mr. Kildee's bill. It also includes provisions that authorize funds for replacement of fountains that contain lead in schools, as well as pipe replacement in schools to address school lead contamination. Mr. Tonko has a bill, the Aqua Act, that also is comprehensive. It provides some additional funds for lead, but it isn't really focused on lead primarily. Gottheimer has a bill, the Lead-Free Schools Act, that amends the lead and copper rule broadly, not just for schools, and provides grants for school fountain replacement. And I'll just say we have one big worry about the so-called Regulatory Accountability Act, which has passed the House and is about to go over to the Senate, is in the Senate and was recently introduced last week in the Senate. We think it would basically block any improvements to the lead and copper rule. It would block probably most improvements to any current regulations or any new rules from the meat safety world to the drinking water world. It erects a lot of barriers before an agency can move forward and is very problematic. We're hoping that's not going to go anywhere because it could kill any action under any of these bills, frankly. States are also addressing this a little bit. So a few states, first of all, there was a provision in the Safe Drinking Water Act that required schools to test for lead. It was, frankly, poorly drafted. It was overturned in a court decision because it imposed direct requirements on states and didn't make that dependent upon getting grants or not. So the court overturned on constitutional grounds. A few states have done things on this front. Both Illinois and New York have some testing requirements for schools. California is looking at that. Several other states are looking at testing requirements for schools. But there really isn't a comprehensive approach out there to deal with lead in schools. There are a series of breakdowns and gaps. I'm not going to go into the details. I've mentioned some of them. We have enforcement issues, and we also have problems with testing, especially in the lead arena where the testing, there are a lot of ways that it will not detect problems the way it's framed out, and we need to fix that. The problems seem to be worse. Obviously, there was a very good GAO study that came out that looked at Detroit and other cities that have lost population, Flint and others, talking about how these are real challenges for a lot of Midwestern cities. Also big problems in tribal lands, smaller systems in rural areas, and several other key areas that have serious problems with drinking water. So happy to answer questions later. Our view is that this is an important essential element to life and that everybody should have an enforceable right to drinking water. So let me introduce Gary Brown, who's the director of the City of Detroit's Water and Sewage Department.
Thank you, Eric.
Sure.
Anybody from Detroit? Anybody from Michigan? Okay. And you understand a little bit about what I'm about to talk about. I am the director of the Detroit Water and Sewer System. I'm also on the board of directors for the Great Lakes Water Authority. And the system probably, arguably, is one of the largest single source systems in the world. Certainly one of the largest municipalities in this country. Services probably about 60% of the state. That's how big this system really is. And, you know, I put the first picture up really to just show you how level and flat Detroit is, because we have more single family homes than any other city that I know of in America. And you have a city that not too many decades ago was built for 2 million people and had 2 million people. So you had housing available for 2 million people. And today we have less than probably 650,000 trying to provide dollars to upgrade a system that was built for 2 million people. Detroit's barriers to addressing is estimated 125,000 lead service lines. And I don't know what Flint has, probably. And let's just say they have 25,000, and I don't know if it's
that. Around
17,000. We have 125,000. I'm not knocking Flint, but I'm not sure they're able to do two lead service line replacements a day. How long is it going to take me to replace 125,000? What is it going to cost? And I'm all for the regulation that you've heard, the improvements. You'd be an idiot to argue against the safety of that regulation. But with the regulation comes cost. How does it get paid for? And one of our biggest issues is water affordability right now. We have billions of dollars in bond dollars in legacy debt that a population in the city of Detroit that's got arguably 40 and probably closer to 50% poverty with some of the highest rates in the nation. How do they pay for an additional $500 million worth of new infrastructure in the replacement of lead service lines. How does that happen? So if EPA comes out with this new regulation and mandates that in America we're going to replace all the lead service lines within 10 years, I'd have to replace 10% of my lines a year for the next 10 years. And how do I pay for it? That's the question. You heard from the other speakers about how the system works, where the lead service line, and right now, I have crews out doing partial lead replacement because the homeowner owns the portion of the lead service line from the stop box to inside their house in their meter. I don't have, as a utility, an easement to go on to private property, and it will be illegal for me to spend my ratepayer dollars to improve a person's personal property. And so even if I wanted to replace the full service line, right now I don't have the legal ability to do it. So while I'm replacing water mains in neighborhoods, it would be unconscionable for me not to replace my portion of the line and then try to find a way to get control of my customer's portion of the line, and by the way, try to figure out a way to pay for it. So we need changes and we need funding. I took over the water department and I was chief operating officer of the city of Detroit prior to that for 3 or 4 years. When I took over the water department, it had bifurcated into two different entities. It's this billion-dollar utility that split into two. And January 1st of 2016, this is what I walked into. The United Nations was in the city of Detroit protesting the number of shutoffs that were going on in the city, saying that basically water was a human right and that you should stop doing the shutoffs immediately. And it's really about the level of poverty that's going on in the city of Detroit right now. Detroit pays some of the highest rates in the country. I spoke to that. Residents, 50% of my 175,000 residential customers are renting. They don't even own that piece of property. So how do I knock on the door and ask them? Number one, they couldn't give me the legal authority to replace that portion of the line because they don't even own the property. And we've drilled into our customers as a utilities heads, other than Flint, that the water is safe. And so if someone does have $5,000 or $6,000 extra dollars laying around, they want to remodel the kitchen or put a new deck on. The last thing they want to do is replace an underground piece of infrastructure that they've been told is safe. Detroit will be the epic center of lead service line replacements in the United States. I argue that we probably have more than most of the eastern ports, cities on the East Coast combined. 125,000 lead service lines because of our geographical makeup. Our homes were all built before the 1950s when the primary material being used was lead. And we built 2 million, we built enough housing for 2 million people. And now we have 650,000 trying to support the infrastructure of a system that was really meant for 2 million people to pay for. And so this map, this is no map. I really just put it up to show you, I think, a Detroit Free Press article that had come out that you could set the city of Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan inside the city of Detroit and still have room left over. The population, that's from 2 decades ago, 1 million people. We haven't had 1 million people in 2 decades. The last census we had 970. Today, I think we lose 10,000 a year for the last 3 to 4 years. That will continue until that starts to stabilize. So we have about 670,000 people right now. Full service line replacement program. You know, in 2018, I intend to convince the politicians in the city of Detroit, the legislative body, and by the way, I was a part of that body. I was on the Detroit City Council for at least 4 years. I got to convince the city council. I got to convince the mayor. I got to try to convince my board. I've also got to convince the Great Lakes Water Authority board that we should take control of a person's personal property and we should replace the full line. And then they're going to ask me, how are you going to pay for it? And we're still yet to figure that out. And that's why if Washington is going to pass legislation that mandates this regulation, then they're going to also have to find ways to help cities such as Detroit to pay for it. We want to eliminate doing partial replacements, use copper, complete full lead line service replacements. Homeowners and residents will need to sign a waiver. If I take control and capitalize their portion of the line, I got to get them to indemnify the utility so that they can't say that when we were working on putting the new line in, they want to sue me for damage that was done to the property. That in and of itself is going to be a huge issue to get over. So there's legal funding policy and technical portions that have to be finalized before I can commit to doing full lead service line replacement. Public transparency and community outreach on lead service lines. I think that's where Detroit really dropped the ball. I think in a lot of ways in this space they've been leaders. Certainly they had a corrosion control program in place way before EPA mandated it, which is why we have had the good results that we've had. If Flint had not switched over and at least put in a corrosion control program, I don't even think we'd be here talking today. They've changed the way this industry is going to deal with lead service lines all over the country. They certainly have affected me in a way that is both good and bad. We have to create outreach materials to inform our customers on how they should be treating their homes and how they should be looking at the parts of the piping that is inside their home that could have lead components. Or I just found a home yesterday that had all lead service lines in it. So that portion is the customers, and we've got to teach them how to do that. Offer lead sampling, which we're currently doing. We're conducting a pilot program right now in the city of Detroit to try to gather as much data as we can about this issue. Small water utilities need additional support to address lead service lines. I think in the city of Detroit, if you know the city, there are two small cities that sit right in the middle of our city, Hamtramck and Highland Park. They certainly can't afford to hire the experts that city of Detroit can afford to do. And so there are lessons that we could provide to Flint as well as to other smaller communities that we've learned. And I think there could be some synergies in which they could help us offset some of the cost. Call to action. What are we asking? Full lead service line replacements are the right thing to do. I mean, there's a lot of discussion right now going on in Washington about what's going to happen with EPA. And when I'm talking to the community in the city of Detroit, I said, who cares? If they were to disband EPA or not come out with new regulation and say that we have to do these lead service line replacements, we should do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. We shouldn't be waiting on government to tell us what is the right thing to do. We need to replace full service line replacements, whether EPA comes out with the regulation or not, because it is absolutely the right thing to do. We need to invest in our infrastructure. We must have support for cities to reinvest in water and sewer infrastructure, including full lead line replacements. We need state revolving funds necessary to enable water utilities to retain lead and copper experts and replace the pipes with least cost to the taxpayers. Low-income sewer water assistance program legislation, which recognizes that as water and sewer rates rise, federal state support of low-income customers is needed for both usage and infrastructure. Creating best practices for service line ownership. It is more cost-effective for community and water utility for the municipality to own the entire line. What you're really saying, if I'm going to force the customer to pay for their portion of the line, you're really saying that the wealthy, the middle class, who can afford it, will have safe pipes. And you're really saying that poor people who can't afford it will not. And I don't think anybody with any rationale would want that. Federal and state grant and loan programs that better facilitate public-private partnerships in addressing the replacement and outreach efforts. So basically, you've heard from the academic side of the house and the health side of the house and the technical experts, and I'm here to talk about the operationally, how do we actually get it done from an operational standpoint? How do we pay for it? We all agree that the regulation is needed to make our communities safe, but we can't just send an unfunded mandate to cities around the country to do something and then not give them the wherewithal or the financial support to be able to get it done. So with that being said, I'll turn it back over to Elin for maybe Q&A. Or...
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. We're right at the 3 o'clock mark, so I think we can stay here for some questions if you have some, but I know that some of you probably have to go. Yes.
In your last slide, you mentioned there you've raised a low-income sewer water assistance program. This is a new idea, similar to a LIHEAP, but to help homeowners.
Yeah, I argue in Detroit, and I challenge the media to fact-check it, and I challenge you to fact-check it. I think Detroit has the most comprehensive, robust, compassionate, generous residential assistance program in America. And we go into a person's home, there's only one qualification, 50% below the poverty line. And that is 50% of Detroiters. That's the only qualification. We will go into their home. We will do an audit. The water department will do the audit. We won't hand them a list of contractors to say, fix your leaky pipes, because that's what's driving your high cost for your bill, leaky pipes. Then we go in and we fix those pipes up to $1,000. It's good for conservation for us. We're not having leaking water go into our system. And then I tell the customer that I will give them $25 a month on their monthly bill, which the average is $75. I freeze their arrears. The average arrears in Detroit is $663. So we go in, we do the audit, we fix the leaky pipes at our cost up to $1,000. We give them assistance of $25 to get their bill to a $50 fixed amount. If they make a $50 payment for 6 months, I pay half their arrears off. If they make it for a year, I pay them completely off. That is much more generous than LIHEAP or any utility in America, whether you're talking about gas, lights, or water. And so when you read about my utility cutting off right now, there's articles being written about there's 18,000 customers that are at risk of being shut off. The only customer in the city of Detroit that's at risk is the one that will not open his bill and ask for assistance. Every single residential customer in the city of Detroit has a path not to be shut off, but you have to ask for the assistance, and you have to open up that bill. If you don't, then you will be subject to shut off. If you are shut off, you're back on within 24 hours, because then I have your attention and I get you into an assistance program. And so I think it's... We studied this issue. I brought in experts from all over the country. We wrote a blue ribbon panel, and I think on my last slide there's a link to it where you might be able to find that, and we're pretty proud of that program.
I'll just say one other thing about that. There was a really good review of this by a broad array of stakeholders. The National Drinking Water Advisory Council issued a report. I'm going to say it's about a decade old now. But it reviewed water affordability and different programs, a LIHEAP bike program for water, rate structures, some of the innovative things that we're hearing about from Detroit are a real advance. I think there are a few cities that are doing this. American Water Works Association also did a review of some of these programs that was published in last year sometime. So certainly give me your card and I'm happy to send you links to those documents. A lot of thinking needs to go into this because it's certainly an issue, and we don't want anybody to have their water shut off because they can't afford it.
Is there any other questions?
Can I ask Gary a question?
Oh, sure.
Gary, a couple of cities in Michigan, including Flint now and Lansing, are doing full lead service line replacement. I know that Milwaukee wants to do that, and they have to go to the state legislature to get approval. Do you feel like you have to get a change in the, not in state law, but in the city ordinance or something.
Yeah, we have to have a city ordinance in order to get control of the line. But I'm going to have to convince the legislative body in the city of Detroit that I'm not going to raise a residential rate by $300 a month by taking control of those lines. So they're going to want to know how we're going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go out to their constituents and say that we're doing something that's going to make water even more unaffordable in the city of Detroit. So until you solve how you pay for it, it's going to be difficult to get that legislation passed. But I'm vowing by 2018 to have it done.
Love to work with you on that.
Yes. I'll help you get it. Can I just say on the other, just on the other affordable, Michigan has, you know, some unique laws that other states don't have. There's a lot talked about in Philadelphia about affordability. But in Michigan, we have a Supreme Court decision called Bolt versus Lansing, as well as the Headley Amendment, that will not allow me, the utility, to charge a person based on their ability to pay. I have to charge them based on the cost of the service. I can't go in and charge people based on... That doesn't mean I can't have an inclining block rate structure of some sort, but that's a hurdle for us, which is why we have to find other ways to make water affordable, and the residential assistance program is just one of the tools in which we do that. Last year, we collected $59 million more than we collected the year before. And when I raised the collectible rate from 77% to 91% in 1 year, that's $4 million going into the system per percentage point. And so I'm not passing bad debt on to customers in the next year's rates, which also helps to keep water affordable. I just put $2 million into a fund in which we're going to try to replace every toilet in the city of Detroit that's a 5-gallon flush. Can you imagine if you've got a senior citizen that uses the bathroom a lot, or a pregnant mother that might be using the bathroom a lot, and you're flushing that 5 gallons, how that's raising those bills. And so at our cost, we want to go in because we think it's good for the environment, it's good for conservation, and it's good to help keep the cost down for people that are not able to make the payments. So there are a lot of tools in the toolbox, but I just want you to know that in Michigan, Bolt versus Lansing, as well as the Headley Amendment, will not allow me to charge a person based on their ability to pay, affordability. You have to base the rate on the cost of the service.
The last thing I'll just say is there is some consideration given to an expanded version of infrastructure legislation. I know the administration has not yet proposed their legislation. We're hoping that water will be part of that and that it will be broadly available, so it's not just for a couple of big projects, but it would be broadly available. So certainly there is an opportunity for Congress to weigh in, even if we don't change the lead and copper rule and all these things. If we could actually get a significant chunk of new funding to water systems like Detroit and many others that really need the help, it would be enormously helpful and useful. So that's going to be certainly a key point that we'll be advocating if and when we ever get around to the infrastructure legislation debate.
Eric, yeah, even, you know, over the next 4 years, I'm sitting on cash, $300 million right now, to modernize the system and start doing water main replacements. And a city like Detroit, largest city in the history of this country to go through a bankruptcy in only 18 months, we cleaned up our debt, we have cash, and we have resources to be able to modernize the system. If I have to spend $500 million on replacing that service line, I don't have the dollars that it's going to take to modernize the system. And so we've got that out there, and then I've got EPA out there saying, if I don't reduce the amount of sewage that I'm putting out into the Detroit River during rain events, and tomorrow's scaring me to death because I'm hearing we're going to get as much as 3 inches of rain, which will overwhelm my system, which will cause me to push untreated sewage out into the river if I get that volume of rain. If I don't reduce that to zero, by 2022, I have to spend another $1 billion in building these concrete holding tanks, CSOs. And so the point I'm trying to make is, while nobody appreciates the regulation more than I do, I know what the Detroit River looked like 25, 30 years ago, and I know what it looks like today because of the regulation. There's a cost to it. There's a cost to it, and it's scaring us when, we're trying to modernize the system, we're trying to keep water affordable for poor people, and yet we're trying to also not push sewage out into the river and defined as well as be forced to build infrastructure that we know we don't need. We know we can do a better job of reducing stormwater out of the system through green infrastructure. And Detroit's in a unique situation that we control 40% of the land. The city owns 40% of the land. Can you imagine if we turned all of that land into green infrastructure and took that stormwater out of the system from going to the wastewater treatment plant? How much energy I could save, I wouldn't have to pump it, how many dollars in chemicals I would save, I wouldn't have to treat it in my wastewater treatment plant. That's certainly a better solution than to keep building great infrastructure buildings that just hold sewage until the rain event is over and then it sends it to my treatment plant to clean. We want to do this through green infrastructure.